Lunch with Leon is brought to you by Total Care, the UK experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Visit totalcare.co.uk and learn about their market-leading mobile column lifts, fixed post lifts, brake testers, inspection pits, and more. Total Care, lifting business one vehicle at a time.
Welcome to Lunch with Leon. I'm having the greatest time having lunch with my friends from around the world of transport. One day soon, it might even be a real lunch. You never know where we're going to be and what we're going to talk about, but whatever it is, there's always so much to learn. So this week, I'm joined by Anna Whitty, MBE, Chief Executive of Ealing Community Transport. It would be easy to come to the conclusion that this is just an offshoot of the local council just carrying some wheelchair users. But in fact, none of that is true. In fact, it's so far from the case, as I found out. I started by asking Anna just what Ealing Community Transport does.
ECT provides community transport to local communities. Community transport are the hidden heroes of the transport world. People who fall through the gaps, who have no access to mainstream transport, who may be isolated in their homes, and increasingly over recent years, isolated in their villages in rural environments, it's their only access to transport, the only way that they can leave their homes and access services like shopping.
But isn't that something done by the council?
That's an interesting question, Leon, because everybody assumes that it's done by the council. In fact, one of my biggest problems and something I often get asked is Ealing Community Transport, does that mean it's part of the local council? Is it part of you work for Ealing Council? No, I don't work for Ealing Council. I work for an independent charity. People believe that transport is very much a statutory service. But that's why we always talk about falling between the gaps. And like in all services, there will always be people that fall between the gaps. And I've made it a lifetime mission to particularly reach lonely and isolated people. People who often don't have a voice, they're no longer of any economic value because they will be older people. And quite frankly, people often don't care. And in this COVID, new COVID world, post-COVID world, hopefully very shortly, I think it's going to be an even bigger crisis and community transport will be needed more than ever.
So by and large, then, a lot of your customers will be people that can't even get on regular public transport, even if it's wheelchair accessible, even if it stops just at the end of the road. So you're providing a door-to-door service, and that's superior to public transport.
Yes, that's a very good point, because it's door-to-door, it's not curb-to-curb, because there are often transport planners that think sending Uber Assist will solve the problem. What we provide is a door-to-door transport. And you and I will remember the days where the milkman would check, is the milk from the previous day still there? Are the curtains drawn? Maybe postmen would do the same. But all those services have changed in our lifetime. And it's community transport drivers that now fulfill that role. And if they have a regular customer they don't answer the door, they will do something about it. They will check up on that person, whether it's peeping through the windows, whether it's calling additional help.
So that's the community bit in the title then, isn't it? This is the role of the community in making sure that the people around us are safe and well and so on. So you must have lots of really very happy customers then, because they must love the arrival of the ECT bus and the friendly smiling driver at the door.
Yes, we have many happy customers, and I love my job because I normally deal with compliments, not complaints. People are really grateful. People see it as a lifeline. People see it as the only way out. People see it as the only person they might see. A phone call to our office to make the booking, it may be the only person they talk to all week. So these are people who have no contacts with others. In a rural environment, people often retire to quaint villages in the middle of nowhere. and they feel confident that at the point they won't be able to use their car, they've got a bus service that passes their door daily, hourly, whatever the schedule was. All of that's disappeared. And that villager, they reach 80 plus, find themselves with no bus service. And of course, with post-COVID, maybe they have access to food deliveries. Maybe families have arranged this. But then the risk is that person won't have any excuse to leave their home. And we often talk about the apple a day story, that people of a certain age, and the supermarkets talk about the basket shoppers, they will go out every day to buy an apple, to buy a little bit of milk, because it's their only excuse to be able to go out and to be able to interact with people.
So I'm sure that must ring true with all the people who've been stuck at home for the first time in their lives because of COVID, that if you are living alone, or maybe just the two of you, and you are not seeing anybody at all, or just your husband, wife, or partner, that actually the opportunity to go out just to the supermarket, just to buy one or two things, maybe have a cup of tea while you're there, meet people on the bus that you might see more than once, so make some new friends on the bus. So this isn't just transport. This is a lifeline to the mental health of all those people who find themselves either alone or with just one other person and no other reason to go out.
That's a very good point, because one of the reasons community transport will often be about minibuses, because it's about people travelling together to similar destinations. There's often a suggestion that sending out a few taxis will be a lot cheaper. The social part of the journey is really critical to what we do. And you're absolutely right. People do make friends. They do get used to traveling with the same people. They do stop at the supermarket for fish and chips or a cup of tea and cake. It's very much part of what we do. You talked about our customers must love us. The drivers, the staff that we have, love their jobs. They have often said to me it's the best job they have. Because it's not just being a driver. If you enjoy driving, but you also want to be dealing with people, it's your ideal job, because half of what they do is a caring social side.
So, yes, I was going to ask you about the sort of people who want to be on the staff, because presumably you're not paying the top rates for drivers in any area, but some of the people who come and drive for you are definitely, well, most of the people who come and drive for you aren't there for the money. They're there for the nice job, the nice surroundings, and the nice passengers.
Absolutely right. We don't pay top rates. We can't match what the mainstream bus companies pay. But we do, as we've discovered, we do pay more than some of the very small local operators.
I don't suppose your drivers are mugged by the passengers very often either.
No, they're not. So it's a totally different job. And when we take people on, their communication skills are critical, because we're very conscious that driver will be the only person our customers, our passengers will speak to.
So you must have some lovely, heartwarming stories then that have been relayed to you either from the customers themselves or through the staff. So can you give us one or two of those?
Well, we often get unexpected emails and I'll give you an example. That one came through from a neighbour who was so touched by the natural way that one of our drivers put her neighbours, one of our customers' bins out, and just wheeling them out to the gate, moving the recycling, whatever it needs, without being asked, just doing it automatically. And so it is very heartwarming to watch. And ultimately, a lot of us have elderly parents or are aware that it won't be that long before either our parents get there or we get there. And to see when you're out and about, you're doing your own shopping, you see this uniformed, smart driver with their ID providing assistance. It's a very touching sight. And I always smile when I see someone very elderly who's out and about, because I think it's very brave of them to do that, And it's a habit that it's so easy to get out of.
Lunch with Leon from ITT Hub. Leon Daniels is talking to Anna Whitty, MBE, Chief Executive, Ealing Community Transport. Never miss lunch. Subscribe on our website.
Well, I happen to know that one high spot of your career and one high spot for ECT was the job that you did for the 2012 London Olympics. So that was something else where not only had it never been done before, but you had to write the rule book, didn't you?
Oh, we did have to write the rule book, and I also had to educate people on accessibility, even down to through language and what do we say? And there was a big focus on just people, wheelchair users. And certainly some of the spectators who were wheelchair users didn't need assistance. And it's about hidden disabilities, it's about mobility issues, it's about where a particular venue might be and how much walking there is and how much of a crowd there is. There were several attempts to put us somewhere out of the way, that there will be a bit of a walk to get to the gates, which obviously defeats the object. It took a lot of persuading, but we got there. And for me, a measure of success is to watch the numbers using the transport grow day by day and seeing people come back. And we saw that very much in the athletics a couple of years ago. That people went out and bought more tickets because they realised that the transport was going to work for them.
You must remember, as I do, one of the first places they tried to put you was on the crest of a bridge. So there's nothing like unloading wheelchair passengers out of the back of a wheelchair-equipped vehicle on a tail lift on a hill.
Very impressed, Leon, that you remember these details, but they are critical. And it was over the crest of the hill, down the hill over the other side. So it was just that particular place chosen at that point was the worst possible situation. But yeah, and we stumbled upon the right answer, which happened to be on a corner somewhere. But nobody kind of imagined it at the beginning because there's traffic. But once you start road closures, things fall into place.
No, I do remember that eventually all the locations were as close as you might practically get. I seem to remember Paddington Station wasn't the best location in the world, but in general, some of those places, including by the Olympic Park, I mean, for people arriving, for example, in a wheelchair, and I know that's not the only sort of disability, but for people with in wheelchairs or with any other form of disability that prevents them from walking very far, you could come off the front of a Jubilee Line train and immediately go through a side door and be on a bus. And your bus would take them then to that spot that you just described, which was itself just a short distance from the main entrance for people. And they had the shortest walk. And I do remember that it was difficult to try and get those locations, and it was difficult to try and find a route that was possible to operate quickly and expeditiously because of the way in which the ordinary road layout was. But I remember you said something at the time. You said one of the things the Olympic Games did was to show the world what good, accessible transport could really look like. Do you think we wasted that opportunity, or have we learned with it?
Well, we haven't wasted it because the Rugby World Cup was very accessible, and obviously we were a part of it. We didn't waste it because it was repeated for the athletics and the para-athletics. But you know, as far as worldwide, Rio, that had a lot of problems, and accessibility wasn't a priority. Japan, well, we were still waiting for that. But the thing we must remember, and I'd like our listeners to know, is that the Paralympics in 2012 sold out. And I think that is no coincidence. I believe that it's a result of the accessible shuttles and the accessibility and the general attitude towards all spectators, no matter their mobility needs. And people enjoyed the Olympics themselves, because I mean, it was an amazing atmosphere that we all just absolutely loved. And we didn't want it to finish. And London was quite different in that we treated it all as one, as called games time, didn't we? And so the spectators saw that, they felt that. And then they thought, well, actually, because we've got this accessible transport, I can bring my 90-year-old grandfather or 90-year-old aunt, a great aunt. And we saw a lot of that. We saw the multi-generational families coming to the Paralympics who were sorry that they might have missed out on the Olympics themselves. And that was a huge success for the organisers.
Well, as you rightly said at the time, it showed the world what good accessible transport could look like. I hope that those lessons continue to work their way through the system. And as you say, like with Rugby World Cup at Twickenham and with facing Are We Not Commonwealth Games in the West Midlands in the future. So for big events, whether they're concerts, whether they're sporting events, whatever it is now possible, isn't it, to get really accessible services right to the heart of where the spectators need to be. And for many people, this gets them back into places they must have thought they might never be able to get to again.
Can I just say something on that? The sort of accessibility isn't about necessarily just the infrastructure. Like you said, the showing what good accessible transport looks like. It's also about the safety on the vehicles. Accessible transport is really poorly delivered at local levels, not everywhere. The community transport sector are the ones that upped their game through schemes like MyDAS, through the caring and the being interested in how to secure wheelchair users safely in buses. We were at the head of that. And yes, MyDAS has been adopted throughout. But in general, because time is of no essence, or cost, if you like, is not our priority. Our priority is quality. We've always concentrated on safety out on the road. And we had a lot of international visitors, and they all said the same thing. They complimented us on knowing what to do and how to secure wheelchairs and how to do it quickly. And yes, we had to think of a way of making that happen quickly so that it didn't become part of the problem. But we were successful, and we were able to demonstrate to users as well what sort of standards, what sort of safety standards they should be expecting as a passenger. I'm very proud of that side of things too.
So I'm also interested then about the training that the staff get. So presumably if somebody comes to you and wants, on the face of it, looks like the right sort of person, nice disposition, good communication skills, can drive and so on. Presumably, before you let them loose with very valuable passengers, they must go through a very serious training and accreditation program.
Absolutely right. We follow the MyDAS training program. No matter how desperate we are for a driver, even if someone comes in with a full PSV license, we will not let them out on the road until they've gone through our whole system. And that includes the interview, because it's about getting the right people. It's about references. It's about safeguarding, very critical issues. And then that person will do an on-the-road assessment. It's very rare we fail, but we have. Then they do a standard session, a classroom standard, where they understand all the legalities. And then anybody who will be driving accessible vehicles, then they do an additional module that explains about wheelchair security and other disability awareness.
And on that basis, presumably, you don't have much of a staff turnover, because if people love this job so much, presumably you don't have many resignations and consequently not many vacancies.
We often have vacancies, but that's only because there's new opportunities. And because of the demographic, we do have people who retire or go on long-term sick. But no, our turnover is very low. People love their jobs. But I spend a lot of time making sure that we can get the best out of all our staff. People often comment about working for ECT, it's like being part of a family. That's how we treat it. And everybody's goal is the same, to make sure that the lady who doesn't go out, apart from on our transport, is able to leave her home. So when you've got a common objective and you're not lining shareholders' pockets, it's a totally different attitude towards your job. And it's not many jobs that you feel that with every day you are making a difference to people's lives. And that's what motivates me, and that's what motivates all our staff.
Join us for ITT Hub at Farnborough International on 30th of June and 1st of July, bringing together vehicle manufacturers, disruptors, digital and energy providers.
So after the Olympics and Rugby World Cup and things like that, you might have thought that all your big challenges might have been in the past. And then along came COVID-19.
Oh, I remember March last year, like it was yesterday, and time before that being a different world.
So tell us what happened in COVID.
Well, we all remember that week where the government was behind the curve and we were all moving to work from home. Everybody was terrified of COVID because we didn't understand it. And yeah, I can still see people's frightened looks on their faces. And all companies, I was trying to have my ear to the ground to see what everybody else was doing, but companies were securing their operations and splitting their teams into two, so that if one lot went down, there would be others to take over, all that resilience planning. So I ended up at home, working from home a week before. And, you know, the schools closed and we provide some school routes. So it was like watching your whole operation implode in slow motion is how it felt. And then on Monday evening, Boris told us that we're all in lockdown and like, now what? And our staff were working. I mean, in theory, we were still providing services. And I put out a whole load of tweets. And I don't think ECT's Twitter account is one of the ones that people will watch. And I'm pleased if I get 500 or I get 1,000 views. And I think that's been a good day. The tweet of "We are here to help" just went viral. And as the government, as the local authority, were trying to figure things out, it actually moved really fast, because on the 30th of March, so that is less than a week later, the Ealing Council, specifically in this case here, were putting together an emergency food delivery. And they talked to us. I don't even remember what that approach was. I think it was some sort of consultant maybe that was helping them with it. And yes, of course we can do it. And so it was all the risk assessments. It was all about doing something we hadn't done before, but keeping people safe. I was working 7 days a week at that point. And I found myself back in the office, obviously, because I had to sign all the risk assessments off and watch the loading and unloading, because those sort of manoeuvres can be quite dangerous at the depot.
So there's community transport already supporting the community by helping those people who are housebound to get out, in particular for shopping or for other reasons, but also making sure that at sporting events, people with many forms of disabilities that would normally prevent them from attending those major events can attend. And also, as we've heard during COVID-19, been delivering emergency food parcels to those people in the community who just couldn't go out because they were shielding, so they couldn't go out for any reason.
The delightful part of the help during COVID was that my staff came to me and said, "Anna, what can we do to help?" So this wasn't me asking them whether they were prepared to do it. They were the ones that had that initiative. They absolutely wanted to help. And the number of people who stepped up to ensure that they could help the community, the people in need, that was the extraordinary part. And everybody else was hiding behind their sofa. Our staff were out there. We were key workers. On the first day I went out after lockdown started, not a single car passed me in my 25-minute walk to work. There was just no one out. And we had our key worker letters. It was extraordinary.
What a lovely story. So there we have it. My guest today has been Anna Whitty, who's the chief executive of Ealing Community Transport. We've been talking about ECT and all the work it's been done. If we've got a message today to transport planners, I think it must be that just because it looks in theory to be a service that you ought to provide some sort of dedicated transport for, maybe like a private hire car or a taxi, what you really need, what the people really need who travel in this service, is the support and help of a friendly driver, perhaps walking them from their front door, taking them down to the bus, carrying their shopping, maybe then looking after them, making sure they get back in safely, and to make sure that these people are generally safe and secure in a way that supporting people in the community perhaps used to be more commonplace many years ago than it is now. So this has been Lunch with Leon, which is an ITTHub.net production. Please do check across to our website. You'll see details of this and our other podcast series and also our fabulous news channel. So please do take a look over there. In the meantime, this has been Lunch with Leon. My guest, Anna Whitty. And Anna, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you, Leon. Thank you.